was killed in a bombing of a convoy near the capital Manama, security forces arrested Musa and Ramadan and exposed them to sexual assault, beatings, sleep deprivation, and other abuses so as to extract false confessions. Their confessions under duress were used to convict and sentence them to death. Meanwhile, Zuhair Abdullah, who was sentenced to death in 2018, suffered a wide range of torture techniques upon his arrest in November 2018, including the use of electric shocks to the chest and genitals, beatings, and attempted rape, according to information gathered from interviews with Abdullah and his family.
So this is something that that ties in with the magic word terrorism, in using that term against everyone who opposes you. Not just are you allowed in these people's eyes to condemn people to death and condemn people to imprisonment and or to forced labor, as long as you can call them terrorists, that will make it okay. But also the use of torture will be justified by calling them terrorists. Every Shia or Sunni, for that matter, Bahraini who gets caught in a protest will be branded a terrorist, and therefore you can torture them, therefore you can kill them. This is all, it all ties together in that game of words that unfortunately has very severe and at times deadly consequences for the people to whom are objected to it.
Since the 2011 uprisings, the Bahraini monarchy has launched a broad crackdown on opposition groups and human rights activists. The death penalty has been imposed on a scale never seen before, to target primarily those connected to political opposition. Bahrain has prosecuted and revoked the citizenship of hundreds of people in mass trials. Most opposition figures and human rights activists have been jailed or have fled, but many have remained and are facing harsh sentences while their families await the news of their imminent deaths in anguish. Observers have warned that execution rates will continue to increase as rates of death sentences and the population of death row continue to rise. It is obvious that Manama must immediately reform its excessive use of the death penalty. Right now, there are 26 freedom-seeking citizens in Bahrain facing imminent execution, all in the absence of international pressure.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The U.S. NATO's rhetorical game of nation building and democracy building, all while funding the very forces they were officially fighting in the so-called War on Terror, is one of the greatest deceptions of the last 20 years. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Javed Nawabi, writer. This article is published under the heading, Afghanistan, the Great Deception. Stay tuned for the details of this article. How is it that 40 of the world's most developed countries involved in the U.S. NATO operation supposedly spent more in Afghanistan than they did in implementing the Marshall Plan in Western Europe, and yet somehow still systematically disregarded where that investment needed to go? If sincerely invested, this money would have gone toward building the central state's administrative capacity for social services and law and order, as well as the agricultural sector, since the vast majority of Afghanistan's population has lived in rural areas for the past 20 years, which is also, incidentally, the region from which the Taliban got most of their recruits. The World Bank estimates that 74% of Afghans live in rural areas, but that number is almost certainly an undercount due to the way in which its figures categorize rural residents who have only temporarily moved to cities. Instead, the agricultural sector was willfully neglected, which contributed to the high national unemployment rate of at least 40% in a country where about 70% of the population is under 25 years old. This is rather ironic when the United States and the European Union subsidize their own agricultural sectors, which make up not more than 5% of their national labor forces respectively, about $49 billion and $101 billion just in 2019. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, a country with a total GDP of about $20 billion that they occupied for 20 years, they could not subsidize Afghan farmers enough in order to make the country food self-sufficient while creating jobs in the rural areas. The policies of the United States and NATO, because of its lukewarm commitment to the nation building, systematically undermined building Afghanistan's central state capacity by avoiding giving the majority of the reconstruction aid to the relevant ministries with the excuse that there wasn't sufficient capacity in the Afghan government to absorb the aid for that there was corruption. However, the corruption was nurtured precisely because the majority of the reconstruction funds went to the U.S. private contractors, which then subcontracted the projects without proper accountability measures, with the end result being that 90% of the reconstruction aid took a round trip, finding its way back to U.S. private security firms, non-governmental organizations or NGOs, and U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, contracts granted to U.S. corporations. Only 2% or less of U.S. spending actually reached the Afghan people in the form of basic infrastructure or poverty-reducing services. The showcasing of the so-called reconstruction investments with high visibility was a way to foster global perceptions about the generosity of U.S. NATO development projects, which in reality, they were building schools without students and teachers, power plants that were not usable, etc. Unfortunately, instead of appointing government officials based on merit and qualifications, The United States and NATO deliberately chose personnel of neoliberal, Ivy League technocrats and warlords, with their attendant foreign advisors leading the transition government that ultimately became an infestation of corruption run by NGOs and foreign consultants, with little to no state capacity being built. As the U.S.-owned Special Inspector General for Afghanistan's reconstruction, John Sopko, revealed, much of the reconstruction money in the name of Afghanistan was recklessly spent faster than it could be accounted for and properly monitored. For this reason, according to Sopko's report, the U.S. ultimately achieved the opposite of what it intended. It fueled corruption, delegitimized the government, and increased insecurity, hence providing the conditions for the resurgence of the Taliban to grow. The last couple of months of negotiations with the Taliban in Doha, Qatar, have further revealed that building a legitimate and professionally staffed Afghan central state with a productive economy for its tax base was never the true intention for Afghanistan, the West Asia region, or the Central Asia region. The US-NATO's rhetorical game of nation-building and democracy-building, all while funding the very forces they were officially fighting in the so-called war on terror, is one of the greatest deceptions of the last 20 years. The reality is that Afghanistan has become one more bucket list country in the Project for New American Century, or PNAC. And again, its women, children, elderly, and young will pay the biggest price. Hopefully, the world will awaken from the belief that the United States regime and NATO, with their shameful colonial legacy and their present neocolonial relations in Latin America, the Caribbean, the West Asia, North Africa region, Southeast Asia, and Africa, can actually bring peace, prosperity, and progress to the global South. The subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at America's disastrous legacy in Afghanistan and the consequences of 20-year-long U.S. military adventurism that plunged the war-ravaged country into unimaginable chaos. And we shall discuss how the U.S. longest war spawned terrorism, poverty, corruption, nepotism, warlordism, and human rights abuses in Afghanistan.
After splurging trillions of dollars to decimate the Taliban, causing death, destruction, and displacement, as well as lying to American taxpayers about a disastrous war, U.S. President Joe Biden finally pulled the plug on the 20-year-long adventure, but not before the country plunged into chaos. There are several things that were wrong for the U.S.-led allies in Afghanistan, from failed strategy, unrealistic goals, systematic lying, hegemonic ambitions, and failure to win the hearts and minds of people. Afghanistan has for a reason been the graveyard of empires.
Americans invaded Afghanistan in 2001, following the devastating events of 9/11, to annihilate the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. On the paper, the goal was to capture Osama bin Laden, the former CIA ally and the alleged mastermind of 9/11 attacks. But in reality, then US President George Bush and his hawkish Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld wanted full-scale war. They saw it as an opportunity to militarily occupy the mineral-rich country lying at the crossroads of Central Asia and South Asia.
I think the biggest problem was that we did not have strategic focus at the beginning of this conflict. We had known since 1996 that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was a threat to the United States and its allies. And yet from 1996 to 2001, we did not effectively deal with this threat. Even after two U.S. embassies were bombed in Africa, a U.S. naval vessel was bombed in a Yemeni port, and other attacks were made by Al-Qaeda on U.S. interests. And then when 9/11 occurred, the terrorist attacks on the United States in September 11, 2001, we didn't have a plan other than revenge. And revenge is never a plan. Revenge is never a strategy. We, instead of seeking to come up with the best solution to the problem of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, we wanted blood. We wanted bodies. We wanted revenge. Our politicians needed to be able to look at the American people and say, we have killed people. We have punished people for the crimes that were perpetrated against us. And anytime you start a war with that mindset, it's not going to go well, because you will get distracted. You will get, you will lose track of what you're doing. And this is what happened in Afghanistan.
For the past 20 years, Americans splurged trillions of dollars and dispatched Black Hawks loaded with special commandos to Afghanistan. Contrary to what you hear, it was not done for nation building or promoting peace and democracy. The goal was to consolidate the military control over the landlocked country and make it subservient to the US. But the one thing successive regimes in Washington seemed to disregard was history. From the British in 1839 to the Americans in 2021, foreign powers have always faced defeat and disgrace in the strategically located country. What Americans faced, though, will count as the worst strategic and military debacle of the last century. The way Taliban's much smaller ragtag army pummeled the world's most powerful military carries important lessons. It also bears testimony to America's inglorious legacy of humiliation, surrender, and defeat in Afghanistan.
The dramatic turn of events in the wake of Taliban's takeover of Kabul last week quite clearly demonstrate the failed U.S. foreign policy gambles and lessons unlearned from the such debacles in the past. But the decline and fall in Afghanistan did not unfold just last week. Every year, for the past two decades, desperate and hopeless Afghans have been fleeing their troubled homeland amid rising violence, insecurity, poverty, lawlessness, and corruption. Americans not only failed to keep their promise of building the institutions of governance in Afghanistan, but they also spawned corruption, patronized warlords, emboldened militant groups, and carried out horrendous war crimes.
Neoconservative Americans and their NATO allies, who launched the war in Afghanistan and spent years defending it, are now busy playing blame games over last week's fiasco. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg blamed the Afghan government for Taliban's stunning takeover. Former UK Premier Tony Blair slammed Joe Biden for the imbecile pullout. Former US President Donald Trump fired salvos at both Biden and runaway Afghan President Ashraf Ghani.
Biden's botched exit in Afghanistan is the most astonishing display of gross incompetence by a nation's leader. I've never been a big fan of Ghani. I always said he was a total crook. I've said it for years.
Biden and his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, in turn, washed their hands off the mess. What they refuse to acknowledge is that the debacle has been the result of their own missteps in the war-ravaged country. 20 years down the line, 90% of people in Afghanistan live below poverty line. National economy remains heavily dependent on foreign aid. The country continues to produce third highest number of refugees. There are also around 4 million internally displaced people. Institutions of governance and rule of law lie in shambles. A sizable population is addicted to opium, and around 90% of its supply continues to flow from Afghanistan. Afghanistan remains one of the worst performing countries on the Quality of Life Index. And more importantly, no Afghan sleeps in peace at night. That is the legacy of America's 20-year war in Afghanistan.
20 years on, has the U.S. military occupation in Afghanistan brought peace and security? Has it stemmed the seamless exodus of Afghans? Have the incidents of violence and civilian casualties dropped? The answer is a resounding no. American presence all these years turned the country into a breeding ground for terrorism and organized crime, most of which was aided and abetted by Americans themselves. America will be remembered in Afghanistan for airstrikes, drone strikes, night raids, drug trafficking, corruption, and regional instability.
The stated objective of America's military intervention in Afghanistan in 2001 was to dismantle the sanctuaries of Taliban and Al-Qaeda. After the mission was accomplished, the foreign invaders refused to quit. That effectively paved the way for Taliban's resurgence, which came in the backdrop of horrific war crimes by the US and NATO forces. One of the earliest heart-rending tragedies came in August 2008 when 91 innocent civilians, including 60 children and 16 women, were killed in the U.S. bombing of a small hamlet in western Herat province. The perpetrators got away with it. In 2015, around 40 people were killed in a U.S. airstrike that targeted a hospital in northern Kunduz province. They again got away with it. In between these two massacres, many other mass murders took place. The pandemic of impunity continued even as poor civilians vanished into thin air. Americans had the license to kill. Night raids also came to represent the most terrifying tactics of war in Afghanistan, like the incident in southeastern Paktia province in 2010, where 5 civilians, including 2 pregnant women, were killed. Incidents like these made Afghans feel unsafe in their own homes. Custodial torture became another problematic part of American legacy in Afghanistan, as the International Criminal Court highlighted in its report in 2017. Americans also patronized and sponsored infamous warlords, drug traffickers, and military contractors in the country, which only bred widespread distrust. Thus, the debacle of the U.S. and the comeback of the Taliban did not happen overnight.
As U.S. Chinook helicopters rushed to evacuate American diplomats from the U.S. embassy in Kabul last week, hours after Taliban laid siege to the city, it was a deja vu moment for many. Almost 46 years ago, the U.S. had airlifted its military and diplomatic figures out of Vietnam after Saigon fell to the North Vietnamese forces. Although Biden insisted that Kabul was not Saigon, the comparisons were natural. The images of a Chinook helicopter circling above the U.S. embassy in Kabul underscored how Americans had failed to learn lessons from Saigon, repeating the same blunders and facing the same results.
Both Afghanistan and Vietnam bear striking similarity in terms of the American legacy of lies. Pentagon Papers, the secret government documents published in 1971, illustrated how then U.S. President Lyndon Johnson systematically lied about the U.S. military operations in Vietnam. Almost 48 years on in 2019, Afghanistan papers published by the Washington Post disclosed the pattern of lies and obfuscations about America's war in Afghanistan.
The biggest commonality is American hubris, the notion that we can come in and we can dictate a solution. We tried that in Vietnam, and we failed because, once again, we supported a corrupt government that was operating against a legitimate, popular resistance in the Viet Cong and a legitimate government in North Vietnam that was supporting the Viet Cong. We were never going to win in South Vietnam. And in Afghanistan, the same thing. We came in and we removed the Taliban, but, you know, we kept treating the Taliban as if it were some sort of foreign entity instead of recognizing that the Taliban was an expression of Pashtun tribal reality, that they were Afghan. And so you can't sit there and say, well, we're going to remove the Taliban, because the Taliban is Afghanistan. It's an Afghan reality. And the fact that the Taliban survived 20 years of incessant warfare and emerged stronger today than they were in 2001 is proof positive that many Afghan people support the Taliban, support what it represents.
According to Afghanistan papers, statistics about massive losses suffered by Americans and their allies in Afghanistan were manipulated, and warnings about the Taliban's resurgence were suppressed by the Pentagon to paint a rosy picture of the war, which translated into the biggest military debacle. It said the U.S. military had resorted to an old tactic from Vietnam in Afghanistan, manipulating public opinion. It didn't happen overnight. From George Bush to Joe Biden, all American presidents have been complicit in the catastrophic situation in Afghanistan, especially by perpetuating delusions about the unwinnable war. In 2015, a senior U.S. military general in Afghanistan went on record saying the U.S. forces were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan, and they didn't have the foggiest notion of what they were undertaking. That happens when invaders lose the plot. The war in Afghanistan, like the war in Vietnam, was based on false premises and was bound to result in a disaster. Will Americans take lessons from it or repeat the same missteps somewhere else? Only time will tell.
The only people that can hold the United States to account are the American people. And while I'm hopeful that the American people will look back on what has happened, be embarrassed by this, and seek some sort of accounting of a leadership, an American leadership that has lied to them for 20 years, it isn't going to happen. The American people were not vested in Afghanistan. We didn't lose enough American soldiers. I mean, 2,400 is a lot, but not enough to make the American people care. Tens of thousands of wounded is a lot, but not enough to make the American people care.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mark Sloboda, an international relations and security analyst. Before we begin, I would like to welcome Mr. Sloboda to the program. Now, sir, Afghanistan is perhaps the worst strategic, diplomatic, and military debacle of the last century. So what went wrong for the U.S. in its longest war?
Well, the primary problem that the U.S. faced is an incompatibility of its means with its mission once they got on the ground. If the United States had restricted themselves to simply a counter-terrorism mission to defeat, strike the Al-Qaeda network in Afghanistan, which was their original and primary rhetorical target, then they probably would have had a great deal of success. But instead, the George W. Bush administration envisioned their mission in Afghanistan as an invasion, a military occupation, and a reorganization of Afghani society and culture along American lines, which is to say nation building. And where they failed is a nation building mission. They failed to win or to change the hearts and minds of the Afghan people to accept a U.S. light installed political system and society on them. And the every single U.S. nation built mission in the last few decades has failed. And Afghanistan, the longest standing one with the most money invested, nonetheless failed more spectacularly even than its others.
Sir, as we know, the Americans invaded Afghanistan in 2001 on the pretext of the so-called War on Terror, but 20 years down the line, they have shamelessly retreated. Now, how do you see the U.S. legacy in the war-ravaged country?
Well, the legacy of the United States in the country of Afghanistan will, of course, not be a good one. There have been lots of problems with the U.S. military occupation of Afghanistan, war crimes, U.S. soldiers hunting Afghan for trophies, torture, the like, which mar its most, immediate legacy. The failure of the United States to build infrastructure, institutions, schools, actually place a lot of Afghans as remembering the Soviet occupation during the Soviet intervention in the late 1980s, early 1990s, more favorably because of what the Soviet Union, left in its place. The U.S. Is leaving mostly behind military equipment of a light counterterrorism nature. And with the United States itself having spent some, depending on your account, some $2 to $3 trillion of its own taxpayers' money on a essentially completely failed nation-building mission with very little left to show for it.
Mr. Sloboda, with the Americans retreating from the graveyard of empires after 20 marathon years, shouldn't they be held accountable for wreaking havoc in the country?
Should the United States be held accountable for its crimes in Afghanistan? The U.S., in the pursuit of this mission, committed numerous war crimes against the Afghan people. Should it be held accountable for these and for its acts of aggression? Yes, absolutely. Will it be? No, absolutely not. The United States is a member of the U.N. Security Council. Two, a permanent member, two of its partners for its military occupation of Afghanistan, the United Kingdom and France, are also permanent members of the Security Council. And currently, under international law, there really exists no mechanism to hold a permanent member of the Security Council accountable because of their veto power over, not only the International Criminal Court, but the UN Security Council itself. So they will ultimately not be. The only hope for that is the Court of American Public Opinion, and unfortunately that is even less likely.
One last question, sir. Now, with Taliban firmly in control, do you see any role for the U.S. in Afghanistan from now on?
Well, the Taliban is not firmly in control of Afghanistan. First of all, there does remain some political and possibly military resistance in the Panjshir Valley, and this is centered around the figures of the until recently U.S.-installed regime vice president, Saleh, who is a figure who has worked closely with the Central Intelligence Agency in the past. And the figure Ahmed Massoud, whom, of course, is the son of his famous Jamhuriyat father. And he is being used as a figurehead by those who seek some type of military resistance in northern Afghanistan, to echo the long Northern Alliance resistance to the Taliban 1.0. But perhaps ultimately the further U.S. role in Afghanistan will be one of spoiler. If they can't control the country, they will make sure that they economically strangle the Taliban, and so doing will try to destabilize the country. Once again, because they fear that Russia and China and Iran, seeking stability in the region and a pathway for the Belt and Road and other economic initiatives, will move into the country. That, of course, does not mean militarily, but it means trying to shore up, a new Taliban government economically. The U.S. will attempt to strangle that with sanctions, with control of the IMF. They've already frozen the Afghan state's international reserves, currency reserves, and they will do everything possible to strangle the economy of an Afghanistan ruled by the Taliban in an attempt to continue to destabilize the situation. If they can't control it, they will want it destabilized for the surrounding Eurasian powers.
Mr. Sloboda, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on the turn of events in war-ravaged Afghanistan and the disastrous U.S. legacy.
U.S.-based historian and podcaster Ali Olumi says Taliban took advantage of the system built by the U.S. in Afghanistan, based on corruption, bribes, and payoffs. Ben Norton, a journalist and filmmaker based in Latin America, notes that Americans were not in Afghanistan for nation building, but to exploit its rich mineral resources. European Parliament Mick Wallace asserts that the US-NATO project in Afghanistan was designed to enrich the military-industrial complex at the cost to Afghans. American journalist Kurt Millis quotes from an article by a former U.S. Marine in which he accuses the U.S. politicians, elites, and military leaders of lying about Afghanistan for 20 years. Hu Shijin, a Chinese journalist, notes that defeat in Vietnam buried the American leadership and Kabul did it again, warning that Asia will turn into super graveyard of the U.S. empire.
And that was our episode on the ignominious end to America's longest war in Afghanistan and the disastrous legacy it leaves in the war-ravaged country after 20 long years of military occupation. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, unloaded on school districts flouting their long-standing safety recommendations for returning students to school and allowing schools to remain open. The article you're about to hear has been written by Lauren Camera, a senior writer at US News and World Report. The piece is titled, CDC Director Lashes Out at Schools Not Following Safety Guidelines for Reopening. Director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention unloaded on school districts flouting their long-standing safety recommendations for returning students to school and allowing schools to remain open. Unfortunately, many schools have opted not to implement these recommendation tools, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said on Friday, 27th of August, during a White House COVID-19 briefing. We recognize and are closely following cases and hospitalizations in children at the same time as school is reopening. In our outbreak investigation, large-scale quarantines or large numbers of cases are generally occurring in schools because schools are not following our guidance, particularly our recommendation for teachers, as well as students aged 12 and older, to be vaccinated and for everyone right now to be wearing face masks. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, added, I want to strongly appeal to those districts that have not implemented prevention strategies and encourage them to do the right thing to protect the children under their care. We know these multi-layered mitigation strategies work. The plea comes as children in the United States, the majority of whom aren't yet eligible to be vaccinated, start school against the backdrop of the highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus that continues to increase infection, transmission, hospitalization, and death rates across the country. Outbreaks have already forced thousands of students and teachers into quarantine, returned some schools to virtual learning, and delayed the start of the school year for others, mostly in places with mask optional policies and low vaccination rates. Over the course of three relief packages, the federal government has directed $190 billion to K-12 schools so that, among other things, every child could return to a classroom this school year. Yet, a recent analysis of 100 large and urban school districts, including the 30 biggest in the country, showed that 66% require masks for at least some, and 68% have policies on contact tracing. But only 10% required vaccinations for school staff, and just 18% required testing. Evidence has repeatedly demonstrated that multi-layer prevention strategies, such as vaccination for all school children and adults who are eligible, wearing face masks for all students, teachers, staff, and vendors, ventilation, cohorting, physical distancing, screening and testing work to prevent the spread of COVID in schools. Rochelle Walensky added, Schools should implement as many of these prevention layers as possible simultaneously. CDC published two reports on Friday, 27th of August, that bolster Rochelle Walensky's claims. One that showed the rate of cases in Los Angeles County schools were 3.5 times less than that of the surrounding community last winter, largely due to the layered risk mitigation strategies in place. The other report showed the overwhelming risk posed by not having those protections in place. An unvaccinated and unmasked teacher in a Northern California school taught students while symptomatic, resulting in transmission to students, teachers, school staff, and their families. Rochelle Walensky said that symptomatic and severe cases in children remained less common than for other age groups, but that they are seeing a concerning increase in pediatric cases hospitalizations, which she said was a result of both the overall increase in community transmission as well as the Delta variant's increased transmissibility. Notably, 50% of 12 to 17-year-olds are now vaccinated, and the vaccination rate among the age group is growing faster than other age groups, with Jeff Zients, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, described as a major milestone. "This is critical progress as millions of kids head back to school," Jeff Zients, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, said. "These vaccines are safe and effective, and a key way we can keep kids safe and in school is by getting kids age 12 and over vaccinated."
Economic divide.
The story of Afghanistan has been front page news for quite some time, and rightly so. In one respect, it shows how waging a war, occupation, and a retreat can destroy a country. And that is what the U.S. and its NATO partners have done. Hi, I'm Kavitah Wayan. In this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at Afghanistan's economy and where it's going to be headed to next, what's left of it, under the Taliban. The exorbitant U.S. spending in the Afghan war, $2.26 trillion. Corruption, waste, unfinished projects, and an expense that will continue for quite some time, even after the U.S. pullout. That's in the form of interests. Was it worth it? Also, we're going to take a look at the Afghan economy under the Taliban. What was the economy before they took control? And what will be their source of revenues? Will they discontinue their opium sales? Our in-depth section will cover that. And then we will take a look at what Afghanistan prides itself in terms of its product and commodity, and that is its wealth minerals. China has practically welcomed the Taliban with open arms. Is that due to the One Belt, One Road project, or with an eye on Afghanistan's mineral wealth?
The U.S. war in Afghanistan has ended after 20 years. The U.S. president justified his withdrawal.
"I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way."
The current cost, to date, $2.261 trillion. This is the breakdown. The DoD, largest spending, $933 billion. The interest, a staggering $530 billion, something the U.S. has to continue paying even after the war has ended. But what does the U.S. have to show for it? Iskald Sagar, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, created by U.S. Congress to provide independent and objective oversight of Afghanistan reconstruction projects and activities. Report after report, the naked truth was revealed. Shocking. Corruption and waste were rampant. The latest report confirmed more or less what the previous reports revealed. Titled, What We Need to Learn, Lessons from 20 Years of Afghanistan Reconstruction, it concluded the U.S. failed to implement a coherent strategy in over 20 years. It did not understand the Afghan context and failed to tailor its efforts accordingly. We were devoid of a fundamental understanding. We did not know what we were doing. Many of the institutions and infrastructure projects the U.S. had built were not sustainable or even usable.
To me, it's billions of dollars that probably have been wasted. We've built schools that are falling down. We've built clinics that there are no doctors for. We've built roads that are falling apart.
Some examples of this waste. Tarakhil Power Plant, $335 million. Used but not as intended and in a deteriorated condition. The Wardak National Police Training Center, $98 million. Used as intended but deteriorated. The most critical failure, the Afghan Army. $88.3 billion spent for training and equipping.
When you take a look at the Afghan economy, it wasn't a functioning economy based on, for example, supply and demand. There were other factors which spurred economic activity. Now, Afghanistan is extremely poor, landlocked, and highly dependent on foreign aid. Corruption, insecurity, weak governance, lack of infrastructure, pose challenges to future economic growth. The Afghan economy sustained nearly a decade of strong growth, international assistance, which pledged around $86.8 billion. The country's gross domestic product, estimated at $22 billion, has grown nearly threefold since the Taliban were driven from power back in 2001. According to the World Bank, three-fourths of the government's budget is funded by international donors. The state of the economy, even with international assistance, was so weak that 90% of the population lives on less than $2 a day. That's according to the former president, Ashraf Ghani. Our guest joining us for this edition of the program in this segment is Mohammad Daoud Avedi. He's the chairman of the Afghan Nation Peace Council. He was previously a spokesman and a negotiator for the Hizb Islami group. Okay, welcome, Mohammad Daoud. You are aware about the situation as it's unfolding in Afghanistan. Since the year 2001, the U.S. has spent, it's estimated, $2.226 trillion. That has yielded a chaotic, humiliating end to America's longest war, because really the money is under question as to where it went. Corruption has been stated from both the U.S. and Afghan side. You have unfinished projects. So the question is, where did this money go? Why did that not get spent wisely in that country?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for your invitation. The money that U.S. and other nations spent in Afghanistan were split in different ways, and was spent in different ways. Some were, most big chunk of it were spent for military purposes. Their own military to come and fight the Afghans. It was not for the rebuild of Afghanistan or building structures in Afghanistan that could benefit the Afghan people in Afghanistan as a whole. A very big chunk of this was spent through the war. But the portion that was spent through the Afghan government in the NGOs, non-government organizations, that money that was spent in these two sectors was split again into two. Some were given to the NGOs and some were given to the Afghan government.
Okay, we appreciate that. Thank you, Mohammad Daoud, for that. Now, as he indicated, their money was misused and misappropriated, and nothing is more evident of that, in this case in point, than what was called Afghanistan's ghost money. Now, this ghost money is in reference to a tactic that was used by the CIA to get money to Afghanistan. It's time now for our InfoNews section, where we take a look at news which may not be that up-to-date, but worth taking a look at, especially for one of our future programs. Our first story comes out of Haiti. Haiti was hit by a massive earthquake recently, which devastated parts of the island. In terms of the casualty figures, over 1,200 lives were lost. This comes after the assassination of its president, and as a consequence, now the economy has taken a beating. Haiti, with a population of 11 million, is considered the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Next story, U.S.-China trade. Haven't taken a look at that in a while. When it comes to trade tensions between the two, the U.S. better think twice about how much pressure it's exerting on China. The U.S.-China trade war is hurting America more than actually China. Trump's unprecedented tariffs and technology war with China, which is now passed on to Biden, is costing the U.S. economy, causing disruption to crucial supply chains and wild swings in prices overall. Next up, fake drugs, counterfeit drugs. They've always been a problem. One report revealed fake medicine now kills upwards of the figure that you're about to see here, which is quite astounding when you think about it in terms of the deaths. 1 million people, that's per year. Wonder how much that is every day. It's quite a bit. That's according to the World Health Organization. And that's five times actually more people that die than narcotics. I mean, the trade in fake drugs has proliferated so much during COVID that it has eclipsed the market which has cocaine, heroin, and cannabis in it. So that's leading to more deaths than those illegal drugs. And our final look is at U.S. food stamps. This program in the U.S., the U.S. president just announced the biggest increase to the food stamps ever. Starting in October, food assistance benefits will increase by an average, which is one of its largest in its history, if not the largest, 25%. So the people receiving the food assistance are going to be happy to hear that. Average benefit, which was $121 before COVID, will now increase by $36 a month. Sounds good, but is it because the economy is not doing well for many Americans? It's something to think about. Okay, it's time now for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but we'll be right back after a quick pause.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Now that the Taliban have overtaken Afghanistan, how are they going to make sure that they have an operational economy? Well, these are some of the questions that sooner rather than later they have to deal with. For example, how are they going to run a finance ministry and also a central bank? Central bank is obviously very key. As of now, the U.S. has actually blocked close to $9 billion of its money overseas. They're not going to let the Taliban access it, so that's going to be a very key question. Next up, how will foreign donors actually be able to trust them with aid? Now, the aid for Afghanistan is something that happens on a yearly basis. Many countries around the world contribute to Afghanistan because obviously it's a country that's been racked with wars, years of wars. So that's a very key question there also. And then the next question, since many of them are sanctioned, many Taliban members, how will they access the world financial system?